To Computer Science, E259. My name is David Malin, and this is the last of the semester's 14 lectures, which brings us to lecture 14, XForms, XLink, XPointer, XInclude 1.0, and XML-based XML encryption, XML key management, and XML signature. Tonight is really about tying up loose ends and finishing up the course and rattling off as best we can in one lecture as many other outstanding XML-related languages or technologies, such as those you see here. We'll also wrap up the course tonight, have a bit of fun, and begin with two things, one of which is a throwback to lecture one. You'll recall I put up a few slides on folks' opinions on XML, and I think one of the first things I said in lecture one was XML. It's what? Just open tag, close tag. There's really little more magic than that. But hopefully what you've seen over the course of the semester is that even with those very simple constructs, we've done some pretty interesting things. Now tonight, in fairness, I think you'll see some less interesting things that are being done with XML, or at least things that are not nearly as compelling as some of the things we've spent entire lectures on, but it's really meant just to give you a quick exposure to other things that are out there that may or may not that you may not or may or may not find particularly compelling, but at least you'll have seen it. So we'll do a cursory look at a number of these things. But recall these two quotes. So these were recalled from two students who, at the course's end, offered their perspectives on XML, one of whom said, "XML is beautiful, but as with beautiful people, it is neither easy to get along with nor quick." I'm actually quite impressed that someone came up with that on the fly and during class, but it was one of my favorites. And the second was perhaps even more telling and true. XML's strength is its wide adoption and excellent tools. XML itself is really not that exciting. So what I'd like to do is invite you all to just take 2 minutes to give me your thoughts on XML on a piece of scrap paper, or you can even tear off the last page of tonight's lecture notes, which have just a repeat of the first slide. And just you don't have to aspire to get on next year's slide for lecture one, but just your perspective on XML. When someone says, "What is XML all about? What have you found its value to be? What's been your reaction to it?" Any variation of one of those questions, just give me a sentence or two on your perspective on XML. And take a remote control with you.
Want me to pause for a couple minutes?
Sure. So a look back to two lectures ago when David Lieberman from HBS visited us. That was, recall, our guest lecture on AJAX, which was meant to give you a taste of a very much XML-based technology that's becoming all the more popular for various reasons. You've seen it in things like Google Maps. David showed you a couple of particularly administrative tools which were making use of it. But in your own words, what is AJAX good for? What can it be used for? Yeah.
I think it's a great way to make a web application more like a desktop application.
Great way of making a web application more like a desktop application. Absolutely. How does its use contrast with, say, current implementations of websites? Someone else? Yeah, you're getting a much. Exactly. You no longer necessarily have this entire pageful refresh of content. Rather, things are more interactive. You have really the illusion of what's a client-side application when really stuff is going on behind the scenes. And the acronym, though it's not particularly important to know what it stands for, it actually does rather explain what it is. What does AJAX stand for? Asynchronous JavaScript and XML. So asynchronous JavaScript and XML. What does that mean? Well, asynchronous means that the transactions are going on behind the scenes. Just because some request has been made by the browser behind the scenes to the server doesn't mean you have to sit there waiting while, say, Internet Explorer's globe spins or as the page remains white before the content comes back. Rather, you have the illusion that you can continue interacting with the web page even whilst something else is going on behind the scenes. It uses, of course, JavaScript. That is one of those for better or for worse decisions, but such is the case. And obviously the transactions, as you discussed with David, were going on behind the scenes as XML. Yeah?
You said the illusion. So, I kind of understand, but is that just saying, because usually if we see the hourglass going, you know, the docking interacts with the page, you know something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a downside of AJAX where something's going on in the background? So if you change because you don't know what's actually happening, is that script still actually running on the server once you?
That's a good question. So I say illusion of asynchronicity. I mean, it's sort of, that's probably a poor choice of words, because precisely what's going on is this asynchronous transaction. Is a user likely to get confused, or is code perhaps running even when you don't realize it? Absolutely. I mean, this is why a lot of sites that are beginning to use AJAX will have their own sort of please wait type of messages, or some kind of spinning icon that's being done with layers and so forth, or animated graphics. So absolutely, code is being executed behind the scenes, but one of the things that's worth bearing in mind, as David noted 2 weeks ago, is that JavaScript is relatively limited in its security model as to what it can do with your computer. So unlike other, say, client-side languages like a Java applet, it is sort of fundamentally even more restricted in what it can do. But absolutely, sure, something could be going on behind the scenes and the user has no idea that it's happening. In fact, a number of connections might be opening up in the background, socket connections and so forth, but that's by design. And if you recall, I know some of the code, a lot of the code was really hard to see on the overhead, I think, as he was demoing it, which was unfortunate given the size of the screen. But what I did link up on the course's lectures page, if you didn't notice already, is a bunch of tutorials which do offer some nice code snippets, which offer some nice demos of sites making use of AJAX, so that if you do have a personal interest in picking up more of this and don't want to bother with a book or something, take a look at some of those links on the website. Recall that one of the objects that David did make mention of in his demos all underneath the hood made use of was this XML HTTP request object. And that is sort of the takeaway. That is the thing that's being used behind the scenes to actually make these asynchronous calls and get back similar responses. And that's in this teletype font for the reason that it is a, say, JavaScript construct that's been implemented in JavaScript or by whatever the interpreter is inside of the browser. JDOM and JXPath, sort of tangential to what David Lieberman was talking about with regard to AJAX, but it was interesting that these came up in that discussion because, as he notes, they are particularly useful APIs. Essentially, if you Google JDOM, you'll go right to JDOM.org. Google JXPath, and you'll go right to one of the Apache's websites for JXPath. Essentially, these are Java-based APIs, the first of which, JDOM, is a much better API than DOM itself. Recall that we programmed very little in DOM itself. We did a demo in class. You might have made use of it yourself, but it's a very cumbersome API, and the idea of using DOM to traverse an XML document itself is not an elegant approach because, for instance, bear in mind that children, for instance, of nodes are stored not as an N-ary relationship where you have the nodes being children of, say, one parent, but rather you have, in fact, more of a linked list structure, right? We have this hybrid approach of linked lists with trees ultimately constituting a DOM, which just makes navigation of a DOM annoying, if nothing else, when you're doing it with the DOM API itself. DOM itself is independent of Java. It's written in a platform-neutral language, a pseudocode of sorts, so that it can be implemented in Java, in C++, in any language. JDOM, though, is Java-specific, and it's meant to take advantage of various Java features and Java syntax to give the programmer a greater comfort with the manipulation of what is an XML tree, but it is specific to Java. JXPath is similarly a Java-specific implementation of an XPath-like processor that allows you to execute XPath-like queries on Java data structures. For instance, a Java object that inside of which, through member variables and so forth, might itself have some sort of hierarchical structure. Well, JXPath allows you to traverse those various fields and so forth rather than by using getters and setters and so forth, rather than by using a lot of dereferencings of references with notation like this. So take a Google for JXPath if you want to take a look at that. It's not terribly difficult. And finally, among the links that David himself provided 2 weeks ago was something like the Yahoo UI library, which was representative of several normalization libraries that exist, among other things. One of the biggest pains in writing client-side software has long been and remains dealing with stupid decisions by different browsers, or at least intelligent decisions but independent decisions by multiple browsers, not to support a terribly large common subset, right? Recall the blink tag years ago. Never worked on certain browsers, for better or for worse. Fortunately, people have taken the time to normalize the inconsistencies in browsers so that you yourself are not writing a lot of code with if conditions or switches where you check, is the user using ID? If so, do this. Else, if they're using Netscape, do that. A lot of that has been factored out into libraries that David alluded to. Last time, Blake, Mike, returned to us for what you hopefully found to be an interesting, more hands-on demonstration or exploration of web services, the source code for which is available online, if you haven't seen that already. Questions remaining about web services, SOAP or WSDL? Anything at all? Yeah?
It seems like a lot of it didn't work. Is that typical?
I would say, and I mean, I experienced this myself when I was trying to whip up one of those demos, it's not as seamless as would be ideal, given that you're using tools that aren't don't necessarily themselves obey a usage standard, which simply means that, for instance, Access, when it generates code, follows certain conventions. If you use something else like Cold Fusion, if you use other tools like some of Microsoft's tools in the .NET framework to generate code, stub code, skeletal code from WSDL, you don't necessarily get the same conventions and so forth. The WSDL might not have been dynamically generated by the same tools. So I think the short answer is that I think that's both part logistical demonstration issues that tend to crop up at unfortunate moments, but also a function of it not yet being incredibly blindingly simple to take advantage of these things. And case in point, I mean, I've mentioned once or twice that you've used, for instance, the Amazon API for web services, which that probably was, and intentionally so from the course's perspective, was non-trivial and probably would have been even more non-trivial without even so much as the demo code that we tried to provide you with, ecs.java and .jsp. PayPal's API is even worse, and even though it's great when it works, I would say a lot of the shortcomings perhaps boil down more to say lack of good documentation than lack of potential for this kind of technology. Well, on the agenda today is a whole bunch of XML-related things, most of which will fly through, but ultimately arriving at a nice conclusion to the course. Before we do that, I'm going to turn the mic over to one of your classmates, Lena Rex, who has been the sole willing participant to give a 5-minute pitch or teaser of her project. I will do the quick introduction by stealing her own words. The title of her project is Radiance, and the abstract for her project, if you didn't note it online already, is the following. The purpose of this project is to develop and maintain a website for a nonprofit organization. It will provide the latest information about the scheduled activities taking place in the parish and maintain parish members' database. So that's it. Let me pass this over to you. And the point here is to point a finger at everybody else who didn't volunteer to do this, but one just to give you ultimately a sense of what some of your classmates are working on. I look forward to seeing your final results in several days from now. And Lena, I should qualify on Lena's behalf that this is still a work in progress. So.
That's right. The purpose why I'm doing this is to make use of all the skills that are taught in class and use it for a good purpose. And the organization that I'm working, that I go to and I'm part of a member of does not have a website. So I thought I'll come up with this idea. And the main main architecture for this project, we have the main purpose is to display the information about the parish, the activities that are taking place in the parish to the regular public and the parish members. There are about 3,000 members in there. And every week they do have different activities and programs that the regular members can be aware of. The main web page or the main page would have the title of the organization, which is the Immaculate Conception Church, and the address and the location, and the other related information. Basically, it will be the current bulletin, which displays weekly activities that take place in the organization. And then there is a link to a new member registration. When people new to the area who want to get information about the parish or the different religious organizations that are there, they could get in and view this particular organization. And if they're interested in proceeding, they could get they could register online. So it's a basically a simple web page where they put in their name, the address, and the contact phone number. And that information is passed as a string of XML and passed to the administrative staff in the back. That's the code that's been written behind. And then the staff will proceed by proceed with the administrative process of sending the application form and allowing them to provide more details about the family and the history. The other link that is there is admin news. This admin news, when the user clicks the admin news, it goes to a page where there's a login and username, login username and password, and only specific users are allowed to access that access the link towards the other pages, mainly because it relates to the members of the parish and to manipulate and manage the database related to the parishioners. Specific staff members are allowed. So that is taken care of. And the other important two links that I found is pretty useful is the county to which the parish belongs to, and they have a diocese. And this web page will have a direct link to that organization, which they themselves have their own web services and web pages. And by providing this link here, it allows the user, gives the user more flexibility and more resources to browse through. And the other connection, which I think is impressive, is the link to the Vatican. And it's nothing but just a static hyperlink, which is a href code that is given in XSLT, but it's a very powerful tool for the end user or the person who's using the interface. And basically how that is done is through the architecture, how it is designed, the Radius architecture is designed, it has four tiers. It's a client, the presentation, the business logic, and the data. And the client tier, as the devices like laptop and computer and PDA are used to browse the web services. And the presentation layer consists of three servlets, the member servlets, the admin servlet, and the Radiant servlet. The Radiant servlet takes care of the main web page and provides link to the other servlets. And there is another tier called the business logic, where the interface to the DB is taken care of. And there's a data tier which takes care of the database. There are about two databases that I'm using. One is the parish members database, and the other one is admin login database. And the business logic, in the business logic tier, I'm going to create an interface which is implemented by Java Singleton Pattern to filter how data is passed from the data tier to the presentation tier. So basically, this is a rough idea of what I'm planning to do. Part of the work is done, but now I have to start coding and implementing it. And for the data security, for XML security, I'm going to use SSL, which is a socket secure layer, which is configured in the Tomcat file. Tomcat supports it here. So basically, that's the main idea behind it. So, and thank you for your time and your attention.
Well, excellent. I particularly look forward to seeing you. Oh, question? What does the Radiant servlet do?
Okay, the Radiant servlet basically is the main servlet that displays the main web page, and it uses certain XSLT and XML files like Radiant XSLT and Radiant XML member XML files, and it connects the other servlets.
Fine, you just hold it.
And the project is divided into different servlets, and it's been organized in such a way. So that is the main servlet, which redirects and organizes the whole project and the application.
So it gives you links to the different servlets from the radiant servlet?
That's right. Yeah, it's the main, and it the rest of them are under them. Yes, the sub-servlets under the radiant servlet. That's right, Tim. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, the results are in when asked this semester, the spring 2006 students, as to what they think of XML. The candidates for next year's quotes may be drawn from the following. One of you said, this is in semi-random order, XML, or maybe roughly that order, XML is a focal point for a lot of the creativity being expressed in computing today. That's a good soundbite. But a second one, XML lives in that sweet spot where humans and computers can understand it, much like ASCII text or a file system. XML, oh, this one's a good one. Clearly trying too hard, all of you. XML will redefine how businesses interact across the internet. It will revolutionize the way businesses do business. The kind of quotes you read in eWeek, I think. But good. XML becomes very powerful with the help of other languages. XML alone is not powerful. It doesn't mean anything. There. XML is simple and easy to use, but tons of tools to learn. Okay, fair enough. XML's real strength are its simplicity and its readability. XML is great because a machine can read it easily and a human can read it well enough to see what's in the data. Seems to be a common theme. And then finally, intentionally saved for last, it will change the world as we know it. Excellent. Put that one in the catalog, how about, next year. Well, just so that you get a slightly better sense, still a teaser, of what those devices are in your hand, I'm going to ask you the following question. Make sure your device is still on. Press that red button to make sure it's on, which means the green light will be on. Flip it over to make sure you remember what your ID number is, the last four digits, and go ahead and answer the following multiple choice question, which is a pattern we will repeat later this lecture. What is your favorite number? From 0 to 9. Go ahead and buzz in with your answer. What is your favorite base 10 number? And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 of you, and I see 9 responses. Come on. So at this point, just to repeat the tutorial, you need to turn the device on first by pressing the red button, at which point the green light should go on. If it doesn't, just come on up and grab one with a better battery. At next point, you want to aim your device, which is an infrared remote control, at this red dot over here.
If you hit it twice,
it'll ignore you the second time. And let me reposition in case it's just an angle issue. All right, there we go. I know it's awkward, but one of you is probably going to have to go like this to make sure you're hitting it. One of you is not yet there, so again, flip over your device. You should be looking at the back. The last four digits are your ID. One of you is not yet on the board. Dare I suggest it's Roman, who's now running from the room? Oh, all right. Well, here you go. All right, and Roman's favorite number was just inputted. What you're now going to see is a graphical display of what the answers were, spread out by choice number, where 10 represents the 0 button on the clicker. It looks like the most popular number by far, well, by 1, is 8, followed by the numbers 4 and 5. Nobody likes the number 0 or the number 2, and then a few of you like 1, 3, 3, 6, 7, 9, and so forth. So we'll come back and make use of these devices. We're going to use them for a bit of fun tonight, but they are pedagogically designed to allow students in what are otherwise large classrooms to actually engage in a way that might not be possible given their own level of discomfort, say with raising their hands, or it's a way of an instructor assessing what students' comprehension of material. We will use it in a more tongue-in-cheek way tonight in our final lecture, but more on that in just a bit. First, X-Forms 1.0. So you have made use of, in at least projects 3 and 4 at this point, HTML forms, or XHTML forms. Open bracket, form, you need to then specify a method, which has been get or post for our purposes. You then need to specify an action, which is the destination servlet, or JSP, or CGI, or wherever you want to redirect that content to. And then you go and have your form inputs, whether they're hidden, or buttons, or text fields, or checkboxes, whatever. As soon as you click submit, that data has been posted then, or submitted via get, to the web server, to where it's then passed off to whatever receiving application wants it. How is that data typically shipped off to the server? Literally formatted how? It's a string. So in the simplest case, like a get string, it's passed effectively as part of the URL, question mark, foo equals bar, and if there's another form input, it would then be an ampersand, baz equals quux, or whatever it happens to be, ampersand, variable equals value, ampersand, variable equals value, ampersand, and so forth. And this should be familiar to you. If you just use something like Yahoo, type in pink flamingos in the search box, hit enter, you even see in the URL, question mark, I think P or Q equals pink flamingos, and that captures exactly what is being submitted via HTTP GET to the web server. If you use POST, how is the information instead sent? Yeah, it's in the body of the HTTP request. So it's formatted pretty much the exact same way, but rather than being captured in the URL field itself, which is limited by spec to a certain number of characters, it's rather in the body of the HTTP request so that it can be an unlimited size request. This is how, for instance, you upload effectively images and such things. You could not base64 encode an image and include most images and include it in the URL string. You must use a POST operation. But there's no hierarchy, certainly, to any of the data that's being submitted to the server. There's no metadata being submitted to the server from the form that gives hints to the server as to what the data is. You have, of course, the variable name, but you essentially serialize the data you're posting in the sense that even if you have some sort of hierarchical structure to the form, for instance, the name field might conceptually be broken down into a first name field, a last name field, a middle name, and so forth. The only way you can capture that kind of information is in the variable names. You might have a first name variable, middle name variable, and so forth. And that certainly works, but it's not necessarily as elegant as you might like. And even if there are conceptual entities on the client side, essentially you flatten that data out during the get or the post, and then you have to sort of reconnect things on the server end. Well, what XForms do is allow you to maintain more conceptual consistency between client and server, to maintain more of a hierarchical relationship between in the data that you're submitting. So here's a bit of the historical background on XForms. It's been a recommendation since October 03. However, it is not in great use. To use it in most browsers, you need to download a special plugin. There is one linked on the course's software page if you want to play around with it, but these haven't fallen into great use yet. But we can take a quick look at what they are capable of, because they do suggest an improvement over, say, just basic HTML or XHTML forms. And what they ultimately do is they really do try to separate, in the spirit of XML, content or data from the presentation thereof. So here's an example, quickly, of an HTML form or XHTML form. All this thing is a form that essentially allows you to fill out some kind of credit card information or specify that you want to pay by cash. So if you sort of visually parse this yourself, it's going to be submitted to payment.asp. It has a radio button, which can either be associated with cash or credit card. And if it's for credit card, you want to then presumably type in your credit card number to this text field, and so forth. So it's a relatively simple HTML form. And if you'd like to look at this example in particular, it's actually adapted from one of the W3 Schools tutorials if you want to do some follow-up to this class on what XForms might do. It essentially looks like this. Really no magic there. Something you could certainly whip up yourself or have whipped up effectively yourself. Well, what would you be doing in X forms? Well, with X forms, you'd instead have, this is unnecessarily dramatic, you'd instead have essentially a setup like the following, and I've used ellipses to get rid of some of the details that aren't particularly interesting for tonight's discussion, but you essentially include some more metadata than you might currently be used to, but the real interesting stuff actually follows on the latter half of this example, and this is included in tonight's printouts, even if we move somewhat quickly through the printouts. So this is the lower half of the same web page, embedded in which is some XForms elements. For this to display properly in a web browser, you would again have to have some kind of XForms processor installed in the form of a browser plugin. But you can sort of infer from the, albeit verbose, XML in this document exactly what now is constituting this form. So notice that at the top we have an XForm element, an XForm namespace specifying a select one element. And again, we won't spend much time on this, but the implication there is that this is the sort of trigger that allows the user to select one of, say, a number of options. This is going to be our equivalent of cash versus credit. Notice, though, what's embedded inside of that. You have an XForm choices element, almost similar in spirit to our schema discussion, inside of which are item elements, each of which has perhaps a value associated with it, as in this case, cash or credit, but also a caption associated with it. So again, even though all of the content is there as it was before, we've already separated semantically the actual data, the values, from, say, the presentation thereof, the captions, for instance, by tagging them not with a paragraph tag or a div tag, but rather with some semantically interesting tag like XForm colon caption. Well, if you scroll your eyes down a bit further, you'll see another input type. This time, it is a input, XForm colon input element, inside of which is a caption for it as well, below which is another input for expiration date, finally, below which is a submit element, which similarly has a caption associated with it. So again, no real magic here, and it's quite more verbose than before, but the fundamental distinction is that we've now teased apart what is metadata, you know, enter your credit card number here, from the actual content that we want to submit, values like cash or credit and so forth. So ultimately, what gets submitted, and this is the interesting part, when that user clicks submit, assuming the browser adheres to the W3C's recommendation for XForms, i.e. the plugin is operating as it should, what actually gets submitted via HTTP POST, for instance, is that. Quite literally. So consider that a packet sniffing of this emission that occurs between the browser and the server. So what you actually have here, similar in the spirit of SOAP, perhaps you have the notion of an envelope again, inside of which is a body, inside of which is the semantically tagged information that was in fact submitted. Consider now the relatively greater ease with which you can access the same data once it reaches the server. It's not hard to imagine being passed through a nice a tool that you might be using on the server, and literally a Java object called body, inside of which are three member fields, AS, CC, and expiration, or EXP. And you can just grab them with getters and change them perhaps with setters. But all of the, even though this is being sent now as XML and needs to be parsed, you've tagged it in a way that you maintain some sort of structure to the document. And it eliminates the very flat file serialization approach that's been taken for years with ASPs and CGIs and other such mechanisms that accept user input. The caveat here, of course, is that not so much in use. But if you find this interesting or compelling, do take a look at the XForms processor we've linked on the course's website, or even skim through the W3C school's tutorial on the same. It's an interesting idea, but it remains to be seen exactly to what extent this is deployed. XLink 1.0. So another XML language beginning with X tonight. This is similarly a recommendation for a while, back since June of 01. This essentially allows you to, this is a formalization of the manner in which you can embed
let's call them hyperlinks within XML documents. So there exists in XHTML the notion of the anchor tag with the href attribute. Well, it's sort of a fundamentally useful thing to be able to say that in XML at large, it is useful to be able to create links between documents in some standard way, right? You could clearly implement this yourself, and we have in myblockbuster.xml, we ourselves implemented the notion of an ID for actors and ID ref elements in the movies for which those actors were related. But Xlink is sort of an abstraction of that and says, well, if you want to create associations not even within documents but across documents, let's at least do it in a standard way so that, again, we can factor out some very common, obvious functionality and let, you know, some existing tool like your existing parser or processor handle this task for you. So it's perhaps best explained with examples. The goals for Xlink, to be clear, are, again, to allow a sort of standardized approach to creating linkages or associations between XML documents that may be n-ary, that may be one-to-one, that may be one-to-many, really in any sort of fashion. And this, for instance, is a picture from the Xlink recommendation itself, but I think it's better explained by way of example because we've, in fact, seen Xlink in use already. We sort of glossed over it earlier, but in our simple example that you might have built upon for your SVG map of Xtube, recall that we had the anchor tag in SVG, but the means via which the anchor tag linked to some resource, for instance, the E259 web page in our terribly simple example called anchor.svg, back several lectures, it actually used the xlink colon href attribute, which really is the href attribute associated with the xlink namespace, which is an arbitrary prefix, xlink, but quite clearly useful, but it's associated with the namespace noted sort of higher up in the document. So we've used Xlink before, and this sort of suggests its utility. It's just a standard way of embedding, if nothing else, a hyperlink in a document in a way that hopefully allows you to leverage existing tools to just grab those links or to display those links in some standard way. Like SVG just borrowed the Xlink specification. XHTML was an HTML invented before Xlink, hence they don't bother using them. But it's built in that spirit of HTML's tags. So you can have more interesting examples, though, than our simple anchor.svg. This, for instance, is an XML document, for instance, called artist.xml. And I've actually removed it from the online distribution just because it's quite clear from it's quite fits quite nicely in the slide itself. So this URL is no longer active. But this clearly is an XML document that has a root element called artist. And then the text value of that node appears to be Dave Matthews, if you look lower in the document. And embedded inside of this element as a series of attributes are a whole bunch of standard Xlink attributes that effectively associate this artist element with other resources. So we're using href again in the manner of here. So the hyper-referenced with which this artist element is associated looks like it's a picture of Dave Matthews. It's a JPEG, hence line 3 of the element here that I'm running the cursor over. Well, long story short, there are different types of linkages you can achieve with Xlink. Simple links, which is similar in spirit to anything like HTML or XHTML, it's a one-to-one sort of relationship, at least in this context. But you can have more complicated relationships, extended links rather than simple links. But again, there are some other standardized ways of describing what kind of linkage is going on here. Well, the title of this link is going to be Dave Matthews. The role that this link is playing is going to be the role of an image. there are then some other attributes there, which we won't spend time on, but the display of this data too would obviously require a browser or a program, an application that supports Xlink and has embedded in it an Xlink processor. But long story short, Xlink is simply a means via which the W3C has attempted to standardize the inclusion of associations among XML documents, or more really more broadly, among resources on a network. Yeah?
Well, wasn't there an extended Xlink type?
You can. Let me see if I...
I'm going to fast forward over some of this. I simply included a DTD for some of what we just looked at. This is the same picture from the recommendation itself that captures the spirit of what an extended link is. In short, an extended link allows you to create an association from one document to multiple other documents, sort of going beyond the notion of an HTML link. Here's some sample XML. It's a little smaller to see, but this is a courses element inside of which are three locator elements, which is the means via which XLink allows you to have a one-to-many, for instance, relationship between an element like courses and multiple other resources. For instance, this essentially is a way of associating the web pages for, or rather the XML documents germane to, three different courses, one called XML 101, one called Advanced XML, and a third called Basket Weaving. So again, this is just meant to give you a taste of what you can do with XLink, but again, you've seen it before, and it's simply a standardization of the notion of linkages. One handout tonight and one remote control, which you'll find more fun than the handout eventually. XPointer. This one has similarly been around for a while, comes in the form of three recommendations. I can't say that I've had the occasion to use this, but it is an XML-based language that allows you with great precision to specify, to point to a location in an XML document. Thus far, we have things like XPath or XQuery, which allow us to grab elements or which allow us to grab content from a document, but it stops at the node level. If a node has a value in it, you can't dive into the midpoint of that text node, for instance. Well, XPointer takes things one step further, whereby you can have a URI, say, of the following form. Here is a very long URL, after which, at some point, is what is usually used as a fragment ID in a web page. So it's similar in spirit to what HTML actually allows you to do. You already know with XHTML, you can jump from one point in a page to another. Same spirit with XPointer, but goes one step further and allows you to specify really what character you want to map to with this XPointer. So essentially what this is saying is that we want to refer to, quite precisely, a location in bar.xml that is defined as follows. It's an XPointer expression. It looks like we want to go into the article elements section child, whereby its position is less than or equal to 5. So this actually looks quite like, you know, an XPath expression. But let's actually see exactly what we mean by specifying something with great, specifying a point. So this is perhaps a little more confusing, but more more exemplary of exactly what we mean by specifying where in, say, a node you want to reference. So the first bullet here, point 1.0 is, quote-unquote, just inside the beginning of the P element. So if you visually parse the tree here, we essentially have a fragment of HTML document, a paragraph element inside of which is an emphasis element under which is big. So we seem to have hello, big world, is the HTML markup in the paragraph tag, but the word big has been emphasized with an EM tag, B-I-G, close EM tag. So this is sort of like a DOM, if you will, for that HTML or XHTML fragment. So if you want to specify with XPointer location 1.0 in the document, you can essentially assign a numeric value to that point based on the depth in the tree or in the DOM at which the node in question is, and using floating point precision, exactly what character you want to get at. So when we say XPoint 1.0, that essentially means one level down and at the zeroth character, so to the left of the first character, which means 1.0 is here conceptually in the document. So if we instead specify something like point 1.2, well, that is between the end of the EM element and the following text node, which contains world. So it's actually highlighted here from the recommendation. 1.2 essentially shifts you over one level down, but two elements over. So skipping over this text node, then skipping over the element node,
gives you a location of 1.2. And you don't have to worry about absorbing this because, again, if only because, again, I personally, at least, have not seen this come into much into play yet, but suffice it to say, for tonight's purposes, that there does, in fact, exist a language that allows you to hone in with yet greater precision than we've been able to with, say, XPath or XQuery to a specific location in the document. And hopefully this excerpted example at least gives you a taste of the syntax with which that might be done. Okay, and again, that's why I say tonight we're really just trying to give a cursory overview of some of these things because their utility or their popularity right now may be in question, but at least it's perhaps valuable to know that there is something out there related to some problem that might arise in the future. And in that same spirit, xInclude. So how about this problem of, which is common across multiple contexts, of just including one document in another. So XSLT has this capability already of using import or include to include one document. Well, it turns out the W3C in 04, after the advent of XSLT, decided to standardize this notion as well. How can we standardize the notion of including one document in another? Well, we can use such syntax as this. If you set up your xInclude namespace accordingly, well, this essentially is a representative element that you can embed in any XML document that's to be parsed or processed with an application that understands xInclude, and this essentially is saying what, do you think? Yeah, get the bio of J.K. Rowling and insert it here. You know, just like the XSL colon import or the XSL colon include element did. Again, it's just a standardization of a very simple notion. You want simple? Try XML base. So in HTML, there exists a not terribly frequently used base element that allows you to specify, you know what, resolve all the relative links in this document relative to this base URL. You might have had to deal with this in Stylus if you ever tried to struggle with, say, back in the day of My Blockbuster, trying to get Stylus's preview window to actually display a graphic that was not necessarily in the temp directory that Stylus generates its output to. That's sort of a Stylus nuisance, if you even stumbled over that. But essentially, XML base is all about the following. It, too, is quite simple. This is a usage of XML base, which is an XML standardization of the means by which you specify a base URL against which all relative URLs in a document should be resolved. So think of this as the means via which you might factor out a common path from all of your relative URLs and so that you don't have to repeat it throughout the document. So useful. Don't know if it requires a multiple pages of W3C recommendation, but you can download them off the web. In the context of XLink, base can be used here. So the first element there, the author element, is clearly linking to Rowling bio .xml again. But where is that document? Well, the use of XML colon base implies that that document is not in the current working directory, but rather at harrypotter.warnerbrothers.com in the root directory. If you use it in the context of xInclude, same idea. What document should be included at this point in the XML file? Well, yeah, this XML file, but where is it? It's at the base URL noted as before. It's no magic, but it is a standardization. XML encryption. So this becomes more interesting because especially as some of you have asked or discussed in your project proposals and your design documents, when you start doing things that involve transactions with clients and servers, the security of the data certainly becomes more important. When you start dealing with web services and you're shipping information back and forth across the wire, the privacy, the security of that data begins to be an issue for some applications. Well, one perhaps obvious solution to encrypting data is what Lena herself proposed. So you want to keep your transactions secure, whether they're HTML or XML-based. Well, what do on your server? Well, turn on the SSL switch. It's a pretty easy solution to a common problem. Well, XML2 offers its own sort of XML-specific solution to this notion of encryption, where maybe it's unnecessarily expensive to encrypt entire transactions when most of the data going across the wire is metadata that who really cares if anyone sees it, and you only want to spend your cycles on a subset of that data. This is perhaps, I think, from a security perspective, of questionable value given that processor speeds are only increasing these days, and it's hard to imagine a context in which you couldn't solve your problem by just throwing a switch on, say, your web server to encrypt all of the transactions. But perhaps as we move ahead in the design of network infrastructures and web-based applications, as security does become more inherent to the design, well, you can't, for instance, encrypt an entire SOAP envelope and transaction if you don't know where that envelope needs to be sent to, right? You can't encrypt the whole data and expect it to get to its destination unless there is, in fact, some data being sent in the clear. Otherwise, to what IP address does it go if you've encrypted the IP address? So there's clearly a fundamental need to keep some data in the clear and some data encrypted, and that's where something like XML encryption would come in. This, too, is a recommendation for the past several years. It perhaps best explained by example. It is simply a standardization of the means via which you can encrypt individual text nodes in an XML document. So this is an example of what appears to be two payment info elements, the first of which is the clear text version. This is what your application, maybe your X form, might generate. But before this gets shipped from client to server, it's probably useful to encrypt the credit card number, if anything. Well, so the latter part here represents the standardization and using the appropriate namespace of how you might send that same transaction, but encrypting, at least the part that makes you particularly nervous. Now, this is a simple example. It's probably good to encrypt the expiration and the issuer as well, otherwise we're leaking information, but we can fit as much with just the credit card here pretty nicely. So this essentially conveys the standard via which the W3C has proposed encrypting individual XML elements. And you see embedded in here is effectively a reversible hash value of the actual credit card number that was shipped across the wire.
Yeah. How is the key specified to communicate with yourself?
So that's a good question, and for that I would actually defer to the recommendation. It can be implemented either presumably in the application layer or in the server transaction, depending on what engine you have actually receiving this document and then handing it off to an application. So that is a question that, because I personally have not had to play with implementations, and I don't think there are terribly many, that I would rather defer. But we could make reasonable guesses as to how it's done. But the takeaway here, at least for now, is that there's still metadata going across in the clear, but the worrisome data, perhaps, is encrypted. And this is what I want to wave my hands at for tonight's purposes. The answer, essentially, to the notion of use of keys is another standard unto itself, XML key management, now already in its second version back since 04. But because my familiarity with this is minimal, I'll defer to the rec itself. Related to this, of course, for those of you familiar with anything related to public key, crypto, and so forth, this is probably even too small to be readable, but if you'd like to read this, parse this visually at your leisure, you will see and can perhaps infer from the tag names the means via which keys are exchanged. And I can say that it's certainly similar in spirit to any other public key-based crypto systems that need to exchange data, that need to exchange a key before the two parties even know each other. This is how, for instance, SSL would work. You have public keys, private keys, and so forth, but I'll wave my hands at it for tonight's purposes. But related, of course, to public key crypto is signatures, which allow you to verify not to authenticate the user sending the data, but rather to verify the integrity of the data, that it has not been changed in transit. There exists a recommendation for this as well. So in short, there's been a lot of work done by the W3C and others. You can see this by their, say, websites alone, just by scrolling through all of the languages A through Z, and there's even more topics now as to what they've been up to. And this, as you proceed, certainly with languages that are less arcane than some of the ones we've just glossed over now, realize that the most up-to-date information can certainly be found among those recommendations itself. And if you haven't already, one takeaway that I should probably preach in this course is that though we don't spend much time looking at the recommendations because they've been processed by people with a better flair perhaps for explaining things, like Michael Kay's book and online tutorials, realize that the definitive answers are always there. And you should never feel shy, I think, about looking for your own answer to some esoteric XSLT question by just looking through this recommendation, because these things are long for a reason, which means there's almost always an answer to your question, even if it involves visually parsing some of the grammars that are embedded in the documents. And we talked briefly about grammars in the course. So with that said, why don't we take our 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll take a look at the notion of data modeling, a conclusion to the course, and explain why you have those clickers in your hands. We'll come back in 5. We are back. So one of the things we never really discuss in the course is how to design your own XML files. For the most part, you've been handed things for the project. You've used XML documents via these various web services and gotten data back from Amazon and so forth. But it probably wasn't until the final project that if your project involved such a need, you had to sit down and sort of sculpt your own data model. And it's not terribly hard to throw some data into an XML format, but it's perhaps worth pausing for a moment to just consider some of the thoughts that are perhaps useful to go into the process of speccing out what your XML feed is going to look like, what your XML data model is going to look like. So as we caution here, it's perhaps unfair to say we can summarize this in just a slide or two, but a few things that I think have been hinted at by the data that we've tried to present you with in the course is that repeating data is probably not a good thing, at least in the interests of efficiency and data consistency, and this is perhaps why you felt some difficulty with, say, X2, because the file format, per one of the final questions in that document, was designed not to so much be efficient in terms of its parsing and navigation, but in its storage. There was redundancy of tag names aside, there was really no redundancy of data in the document. Metadata, yes. Data itself, not really. And that's why we ask that you design your own converter.xsl and propose a conversion of the document that might have been fundamentally less efficient in terms of storage and redundancy, but in terms of processing with something like XSLT or XQuery or XPath, just lends itself to better processing. And that is a perfectly reasonable solution, because if you can decrease the overall time spent on your application's performance by doing some intermediate step, by all means, that's a reasonable thing to do. Consider, for instance, the situation that we had in My Blockbuster, where we had videos or movie elements and actor elements. Well, we could have just embedded, quote-unquote, Harrison Ford as a child element of one of the movies that Harrison Ford starred in. And we could have done the same thing in another movie that he starred in, and the same thing in another movie that he starred in, but we didn't. We tried to factor out, even way back when, the repetitions that might have been possible with various popular A-list actors by factoring out their content and rather referencing them back and forth with IDs. And any of you who have sculpted your own relational database tables, MySQL or any major database engine, probably made similar decisions using primary keys to link among tables rather than just plopping the same data in multiple places. Just tends to scale much better in the end. Don't fall, though, into relational hacks. So one thing we've been trained to do by sort of necessity is, all too often, there's this notion of an address 1 field, address 2 field, address 3 field. Well, don't forget that XML allows you some a better solution, perhaps, to problems like this. Because there is a so-called document order to XML nodes, it's not necessary to define 3 different elements, street 1, street 2, street 3. Just call it street, and then infer from the order of those elements, if need be, their position in the context of, say, XPath or XQuery, what each of those represents. In other words, just don't forget that there do exist constructs that might not exist in other domains, but XML does allow you to do things that are perhaps a little cleaner, if nothing else, than past solutions. Finally, when associating multiple pieces of data with some larger datum, well, you know, what the age-old question is, should it be an attribute or a child element? You've probably experienced for yourself that writing code against elements that don't have attributes but rather have child elements is kind of a pain, certainly if you're using SACS. Think back to lecture 2. If you wanted to parse an element
that had multiple children or descendants. Using SACS is kind of non-trivial because you effectively have to build your own state machine so that you remember where in the hierarchy you are and with what movie element to associate subsequent data, like the rating and the title. So much easier to just plop those in as attributes if you can, because what do you get with a start element SACS event besides the name of the element? You get the linked list of the attributes, which, if nothing else, just saves you so much time in terms of navigation and code writing. But when you start to make things attributes, what do you sacrifice by design? Sensibility. So it's sort of a trade-off. If you have an atomic piece of data, then, that, you know, in any foreseeable future wouldn't even make sense to extend, like we have done with names, right? We had the notion of a name, then we said, wait a minute, let's change that to be not a name, David Malin, close name, let's give him a first name tag, and a middle name, and a last name, and so forth. Can't do that if you rely on attributes. You can certainly change your code in the future and say, all right, henceforth, I'm not going to parse this as an attribute, I'm now going to write some code to parse this as a child element. But the beauty of XML is hopefully that you can extend your existing implementation without breaking it. And all you have to do is add new functionality, not go back and write old functionality. So in short, it's a trade-off. But hopefully what you've experienced with the SACS, with the DOM APIs, with XPath, with some of the tastes we've given you of other languages, you hopefully will at least appreciate what are the implications with going with something like an attribute versus a child element. Simple issue on face value, but depending on the context in which you're using the XML content, really depends on your goals to decide exactly what's best for you. So, a look back, Computer Science E259, you saw a slide quite like this some 14 lectures ago. Recall that the motivations for this course were to try to capture what some of the value of this relatively simple concept of open tag, close tag, R. And we had a few sort of buzz phrases that you might be hearing. We have several more that I'm going home with tonight from this class. But you still see things, XML in the context of the so-called B2B revolution, though those people have kind of quieted down over the past few years. Web services, though, certainly XML underlies the use of web services. AJAX, another up-and-coming technology, ultimately uses XML. Again, no magic there. You could be implementing these same technologies or applications using other protocols, as has already been done in the past for years with the notion of, say, RPCs, but perhaps the beauty of XML is just its extensibility, is its human readability, is its simplicity, and is the number of tools that exist, all of the things that you rattled off tonight on your scraps of paper. XML is being used a whole bunch in .NET, even in things like the new versions of Office. Much more data is either promised to be or is already stored in, say, XML format, so that when you highlight something on your screen in Word and copy it to the clipboard, well, if there's data inside of there, like bold-facing and an italics, well, more so are applications using a language-independent protocol format like XML to capture that data so that you have much cleaner implementations of, you know, object linking and embedding, OLE, across applications, so that you have more compatibility and so that information is not being thrown across applications. And even if it is, you lose the metadata, but you can still retain the actual data that are, say, the text children of what you've copied. XML makes developing websites easier and more flexible than ever before. This is sort of a personal decision. So XSLT certainly has its advantages, but you've probably experienced various disadvantages to it. Whether you use it or something like JSP or with it JSTL or CGI or ASP, hopefully what you're walking away with is a sense that it is at least now an option, another means of presenting data when you have it in XML format or in some hierarchical structure like, say, a DOM. So the goals of this course were ultimately to try to wave our hands at all the silliness of people saying that, you know, what was it, XML will change the world as we know it, and just really tease that apart and say, well, what do you mean? What can you actually do with it? And hopefully what you've gotten out of the course, among other things, perhaps a bit of aggravation over time in the forms of several projects, is the practicality of what you can do with XML and what applications exist. I've tried to be as best we can application independent, right? The fact that I preach stylus is only because my friends wrote it and because I find it relatively easy to use, but there are alternatives. XML Spy, we have other links to other Linux-based tools that are on the website, but what we've tried to do fundamentally is focus more on the
the open source tools that exist. And a lot of them, as you've seen, have come from Apache, which is a good thing because not only is it open source, they are often constantly being updated and maintained by a whole bunch of people with a personally vested interest in it, which means the performance of, say, Xeelin is only getting better. The performance of Xerces, the correctness of Xerces, is only getting better as time proceeds. And being able to pluck tools like that off the shelf, and later, if you decide to swap out your parser for a better one, Michael Kay's or IBM's or Microsoft's, so be it. It doesn't really break any other implementation because much of what we've seen is very modularized. And hopefully you've seen some of the possibilities. Even tonight, some of the things XML could or should or might be used for, at least you've had some exposure to that. And ultimately, just as we tried to do with Project One, we try to focus not on how do you use Stylus and what is the JAXP API exactly, but we've tried to focus more on the building blocks and the fundamentals. And so that lets us say, well, go look at the Java doc if you want to see what more you can do with an ATTR object in the DOM API, because those kinds of details aren't that interesting. And hopefully you, too, feel that you don't need to spend a half an hour of time in, say, class, you know, being taught the 23 different methods that exist for a certain object. More useful, hopefully, and more interesting, hopefully, is the underlying concepts. Well, what is the DOM itself, and what are the objects? How is it ultimately implemented? Why is it slow if I traverse it using this particular API? And ultimately, and these were all the buzzwords that were in the course catalog's description, hopefully you, if nothing else, got a whole bunch of, where's my cheesy word, experience. An exposure I could have put up there too, to a lot of the tools, the most popular ones, the most performant ones that perhaps exist today. And there are obviously yet more uses for this as we try to introduce with, say, Blake's follow-up to web services, also David Lieberman's teaser on Ajax. Certainly all things XML-related are the things XML-related are increasingly popular, but hopefully what you've gotten a sense of too is how they are used, and particularly in a Java context. We focused on Java in this course. It is perhaps appropriate insofar as Java perhaps has the best support to this day for a lot of what's out there. But as we saw, particularly toward the latter part of the course, a lot of this stuff at the end of the day is language independent. And if you're a Microsoft aficionado, well, there exist tools that generate the same kind of stubs for, say, C# as they do for Java. And hopefully with the basic building blocks and the fundamentals from the ground up, you'll walk away with the comfort or with the ability to go figure out now how to use these same concepts, but in, say, another language or in another system. With that said, let me say one thank you before I finally explain what those remote controls are. Chris Mayle, who sits back there all day long and hears me talk about a course that he didn't even enroll in. My many thanks for him for sitting in with us these 14 lectures. And now, I thought it might be a little fun to end with not a rewards of the course and goals of the course, but rather with something a little more, whoops, that's the wrong one, something a little more fun, which is ultimately a test of sorts, I suppose. So what you have in your hands, again, is that remote control. If you could go ahead and turn it back on, because it goes to sleep eventually, push that red button, your green light should come on. Take note, again, of your four-digit ID number on the back, because we're going to do a little multiple-choice test. Right? I've just reminded you of all the stuff that you were introduced to this semester, that you dare say learned this semester. I thought it's only fair now if we do a quick recap and see exactly how much of that experience actually sunk in. So the first question on the table, and I tried to make this as fun as possible, or cheesy as possible, is who wants? There we go. You're seeing my PowerPoint skills at my best tonight. We use animation nowhere else other than in these silly things. This is where we have to wait for a moment. Slightly awkward. All right, so the game here is to play Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Rather than put one...
You're seeing the limits of my PowerPoint skills. Rather than put one person on the spot, I thought we'd all try to partake simultaneously. So what you effectively have in your hands is the ability to respond with multiple choice, two multiple choice questions. So we'll play it on the honor system here. We'll ask each of you to keep track of how much money each of you individually has racked up, and you should probably stop adding to your score once you get a question wrong, because the way Who Wants to Be a Millionaire works is that you continue to accrue more and more money, but as soon as you fail to answer a question, you pretty much walk away empty-handed, or at least with less money than you might have hoped for. And we're not going to dwell on the details, because at the end of the day, you're not walking away with any money anyway. So with that said, let's just move on to the first of the questions with our host. The first question then will be for $100. Again, it's multiple choice. It will have from 2 to 10 different answers. You're simply going to want to buzz in, and what I'll do with Alt Tab here is toggle back and forth to the logging program so that we can keep track of exactly who has buzzed in for what, at least visually on the screen. And your first question, worth $100, is the following. Softball. What does XML stand for? Your first option is extended markup language, for which in a moment you can press 1 if you want to buzz in with that. 2, extra markup language. 3, extensible markup language. Or 4, extensible style sheet language. So I'm going to toggle over here. I just have to hit start. Go ahead and buzz in. And again, aim at the red light, and it's slightly at an angle, so you might have to raise your hand slightly, but you should have 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13 of you. So we have 11 of you on the board, 12 of you on the board. Roman yet again. Okay, so what I'm going to do now, recall the question was this. Tuck away in your head what you think to be the right answer, and the most popular answer looks like it was 3 being extensible markup language. 2 of you answered incorrectly. It neither means extended markup language nor extra markup language. This is anonymous at this point, unfortunately. Otherwise, we could tease 2 of you for getting the perhaps simplest of all things XML wrong. What's that? You got the extra? All right. There we go. So one of you. Great. Okay. So let's move on to question 2. So pretty much all of you except Chris and Roman are in the game still. For $200, your question is, which of the following was a design goal for XML? 1, XML shall not be straightforwardly usable over the internet. 2, XML shall not support a variety of applications. 3, XML shall not be compatible with SGML. 4, it shall not be easy to write programs which process XML documents. 5, the number of optional features in XML is to be kept to the absolute maximum, ideally 17. 6, XML documents should not be human legible or reasonably clear. 7, the XML design should not be prepared quickly. 8, the design of XML shall not be formal or concise. 9, XML documents shall not be easy to create. Or 10, aka 0, terseness in XML markup is of minimal importance. So with that said, I'm going to flip over. I'm going to hit start. You can still buzz in, but I'm going to leave the answers on the board. So just trust that your click will be successful. Then I'll flip back so you can confirm as much. Again, 1 through 0, effectively, should be your answer. At this point, we have only about 7 of you, about just under half to go. This 2, if you're feeling a little insecure with your answer, you should, because you've seen this slide twice now before, or a variant thereof. Now we've got almost all of you, 2 to go. And Chris and Roman, if you want to still play along, that's certainly fine. If nothing else, if people are making mistakes, we can just assume that it's you guys, right? Safe face. All right, that's everybody. So I'm going to hit stop, and the most popular answer looks like it was 0, which is terseness in XML markup is of minimal importance.
That is, in fact, correct. Let's, for a moment, dote on who got what wrong. Two of you said, number one, XML shall not be straightforwardly usable over the internet. Maybe you're just being funny, but that'd be a funny design goal. One of you said, two, XML shall not support a wide variety of applications. Again, an interesting design goal. And number eight, two of you said that the design of XML shall not be formal or concise. Again, a strange sort of goal to have in mind, but the answer was, in fact, 10, and it was last night the only one that I did not negate with the word not, which might have been your clue as well. Oh, I forgot the dramatic moments. All right, $300. Don't worry, we're not going up linearly to a million. It starts to go exponentially. Which of the following is a well-formed element? All right, finally something in more seriousness. One, foo. Or I'll let them read for itself so you can read the syntax. Two. Three. Or four. Let me start the timer. And you may go ahead and buzz in. One, two, three, or four this time. One, two, three, or four. Which of the following is a well-formed element? Let's see, we got almost all of you, about three more people. Which of the following is a well-formed element? Two more. Roman and Chris, maybe? No? No, they're done? All right. Two of you are still thinking then. One of you. Almost there. Come on. One more. All right. So everybody's buzzed in. The most popular answer was three, which is foo. Which of the following is a well-formed element? Well, let's take a look at the other answers. Two of you said one is well-formed. Four of you said two is wrong. Let's poke a little fun at six of you, therefore. One is not well-formed because for an element to be well-formed, what do you got to have? It's got to be closed. So an element is only well-formed if it is, in fact, an element, not just a start tag. So one is not well-formed. Two is not well-formed. Why? All right, you can't have white space. When have we ever seen an XML element prefixed with white space? So that is not even ignorable white space. That is invalid or not well-formed white space. Three is correct. Now, in fairness, this was intended to be slightly a trick question, right? Because the end element for foo is actually way over there. But that is well-formed because you can have white space flanking the element name to the right. So some of you probably have up to $600 now. Hopefully you're keeping track as we proceed with the next question, which is for $500. Which is not a predefined entity in XML? One. Two. Three. Four. Or five. Which is not a predefined entity in XML? You could... You can go ahead and buzz in at your leisure. One through five this time. One through five, which is not a predefined entity in XML. We've got almost all of you. One more. One more to go, which is not a predefined entity. All right, that's everybody. The most popular answer this time was four, which is NBSP, which is, in fact, correct. A pause, even though it's a little strange, is the escape sequence for an apostrophe. Three is what, GT. That is quite, oh, that is okay, but okay, great. Well, GT, let's see, Greek cheek goes this way. So that one you can have a greater than character in an XML document without it being rendered not well formed, but it does also exist as an entity. The only one that does not exist is, in fact, NBSP. And that is a frustration you might have felt, especially if you wrote your style sheets with a stylus or XML file, the former of which tends to be very forgiving when it comes to things that don't exist in the spec, but somehow do in stylus. And they subsequently break if you then use something like Xalin or Xerces to parse the document. Excellent. Moving on. Oh. Quote. That's okay. Then shouldn't have changed your answers because that is predefined as well. Oh, we missed our dramatic moment too. I need to rehearse this next time. $1,000. There we go. Which of these topics, there we go, points for paying attention, was not actually on tonight's agenda? Xlink. Xpointer. Xinclude. XML signature. Oh, wait. Oh, wait. Is there sound to this one? Oh, clearly I wasn't supposed to click that yet. All right. It's amateur hour here tonight. All right, 1 through 5. Which of these topics was not actually on tonight's agenda? This should go really fast, right? Really fast. Did not evoke the applause or the laughs I was hoping for, though. All right, keep it coming. 3 more to go. It's like a free $1,000 here. 2 more. 2 more. 1 more. You should know who you are. The IDs are on the back of the clickers. There we go. All right. Oh, someone did. We had 12 on the board. All right, so most of you did, in fact, get it correct, because all of the others were not only in tonight's lecture, they were also on the agenda. So we'll move ahead to $2,000. Ooh, how's that for dramatic? What I'll keep quiet. Go ahead. Oh, wait, I have to start the timer, don't I? Okay. Can we play that? There you go. You can buzz in at any point. What status immediately precedes recommendation? Recall in lecture 1. I think we have that hierarchy. So we have how many of you buzzed? Just 5 of you buzzed in. 1 through 4. Proposed recommendation, candidate recommendation, last call working draft, or working draft. Only one of these is correct. We have about half of you, almost all of you, which immediately precedes recommendation. And we've seen a technology, a language that was not in recommendation status, but instead was in this immediately prior status, which was, we have no languages on the syllabus. Oh, there's 13 of us now somehow, huh? All right. There is no language on the syllabus, to my knowledge, other than one that is not actually already in recommendation status, and that was? Expat 2. So that makes 2, but there was another one. Include? We'll save that for an at-home exercise, after-class exercise. So number 2 was candidate recommendation, which is, in fact, the correct answer. This is perhaps a tougher question, but thus worth $2,000. And no reason to poke fun at the others, because this was a tricky one. $4,000. Clearly, this is about to be a serious question. So let me make sure to pull up the answer so we'll be able to check your answers in a moment. Recall this strange little demo. Now, this question is the following. For $4,000... which horse was the Alto? Get serious points for paying attention now. Let's make sure you can buzz in. All right, yeah, you can. 2 of you are quite good. Good memories. Which horse was the Alto? Now, if it helps, it's bass, tenor, alto, soprano, in that order, from lowest voice to highest voice. So hopefully that reminds you. That's from lowest to highest. They're not necessarily lined up that way, but orally, that's how they sound. 2 more. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13. Okay. 1 more. 1 more. Who's the alto? All right, the most popular answer, ooh, 3 ways high. Well, I guess we'll just have to answer it this way. So, 4 of you are wrong. No. 8 of you are wrong. I'm not even going to try to synchronize it. It's clearly a better candidate, so it's between 1 of you or 4 of you. So the answer is thus 3. So 4 of you got that correct, which means 4 of you walk away with $4,000. Let's tuck this away and move on to, we're nearing the end, don't worry, it quickly approaches $1 million soon. Which of these is not a type of DOM node? Another serious question. Element, attributes, document, atter. Which of these is not a type of DOM node? Oh, that inhaling means confidence, right?
Which of these is not a type of DOM node? Almost have all of you. Element, attributes, document, or attr, which is not a type of DOM node. One more. All right, we got everybody. Most popular answer. Almost a split, but we have 7 of you saying 2 and 6 of you saying 4. So 7 of you say attributes, 4 of you say attr, and the 7 of you have it correct. Attributes was an entity in the, not DOM API, but Saks API, right? It was the linked list that was passed into the start elements thing, start elements Saks event. Attr, meanwhile, was in fact the DOM object. Now, I mentioned confidence. Woo. Thank you. So I mentioned confidence a moment ago. So let's actually, now that the questions are getting a bit more serious, I'm going to ask for you to specify not only your answer, but your confidence in your answer. You'll notice at the bottom left and right of your clickers, there's an H button and an L button. Thus far, by not hitting those buttons, you've all been buzzing in with medium confidence, represented with green on the board. Henceforth, if you are very confident in your answer, go ahead and hit H. And then your response. If you're not so confident in your answer and it's pretty much a guess, hit L and your answer and it will be low confidence and you'll show up in yellow. But if you're high confidence, you'll show up in red. So now we'll tease apart exactly who thinks they're all that. Which of these can you not find out at bingo destinations? 1, 2. You, of course, checked out bingodestinations.com after that class, I'm sure. Signed up, perhaps. Go ahead and buzz in. 1 through 0. What are your answers? Which of these can you not find out at Bingo Destinations? Again, if you're really confident, hit H and then your answer. Else L and then your answer. If you're middle of the road, just hit your answer with neither H nor L. We got 5 of you buzzed in. The colors of your boxes mean nothing. It will be the colors on the graph that signify your confidence levels. We got almost just over half. Taking your time with this one. You should probably be taking the SAT type approach to these answers, right? Like, which of these is not like the others? Hopefully, this should not be as hard as it seems to be. 3 of you are still pondering. I mean, none of them are even relevant to the course. 3 of you, come on. 1 second left. All right, so what we have now is the most popular answer was, in fact, 0, which is the correct answer. Recall, we poked slight fun at Bingo Destinations because they, in the spirit of Chris's answer, actually, this is what happened. Lecture 1, we taught Chris that XML was extended markup language, but that's because Bingo Destination uses the latest in extended markup technology and thus was not a correct explanation of the language. So great that we started off the course by teaching the wrong material. But it looks like 3 of you were very confident in your answer based on your red there. 1 of you was really confident that 6 was the answer, but you were quite wrong. And then you see the distribution of the other answers up there as well. Moving on to the $32,000 question, which was your favorite project? A survey of sorts, if you will, but again, with a bit of fun. Trying to keep it light. Don't worry, it's anonymous. Just over half of you buzzed in. All right, almost. Sort of interesting, though, to see what people liked. Curious to see if Roman or Chris have an opinion, though. 2 of you, all right. We'll assume those 2. The most popular project looks like it was 3, which recall was Wahoo, followed by 2. It looks like nobody liked my first parser. And 2 of you are just generally discontent, it seems, with the course anyway. 1 of you read so. All right, $64,000. Ooh, another trick, a tough question, but the only one explicitly discussed in the specification. Sloan Square is on which tube line? Go ahead and buzz in at your leisure. Let's not make the same mistake twice. Okay, I got about half of you. Few more. Sloan Square is on which tube line? And this was the only station that was discussed in the spec itself because it was used as an example of how to interpret the file, and thus it was explicitly stated where it was. 1 through 5. 3 of you still thinking. Not sure why. I'm not trying to trick you, really. Number 2 of you left. 45 more seconds of this. All right, one more. Maybe you think you buzzed in, but you didn't. All right. One more. And so the most popular answer... It's 5. It's 5. It is 5. It's the circle and district line, which is otherwise represented with the only course-related expression on the board, which is number 5. So he who was quite confident in Piccadilly, not so much. For $125,000 means just a few questions are left till we hit $1 million. Okay, these you're going to have to think about. Think of the little books where you'd have to like visually parse something and understand what the joke actually is. I spent a lot of time on this. Which of these is the bigger joke? What does that mean? Think of the books I'm referring to are those little books of puzzles where you have to, you see something on top of another, so it's like a cat in a hat. So what's this? Tag, you're it. Come on, it's 2 a.m. right there. All right, how about this one? What does this represent? No? Oh, me in a padded cell. But in your computer science class, you'd think these things would be funny. I wouldn't have to try that hard. All right, 3. There we go. Go ahead and buzz in with your favorite answer. 1 through 3. Which of these is the biggest joke? Oh, tough crowd. 4 of you have buzzed in. Which of these is the biggest joke? For $125,000, hopefully you've been keeping track of your points because you're about to cash out. Come on. Half of you. Actually, in fairness, I wrote this the second question last year, and I had to stare at it for about 5 minutes before I understood what the joke was last year. It's a little abstract. All right, 3 more. Which of these is the biggest joke? Actually, I'm not sure why we spent so much time on some of these. We've spent almost 2 minutes on this one, in fact. All right, moving on. Very confident. All right, so the most popular answer for 4 of you was both 2 and 3. So tag, you're it. That was my favorite. All right, for $250,000. I keep talking over the dramatic parts. Any regrets so far? Maybe there's too much. Maybe we need a little more serious material next year. Any regrets so far? Okay, it's funny when I wrote it. All right, there you go. Go ahead and buzz in at your leisure. I'm sure you distant students are having fun watching us. Been wondering at what point you should start fast-forwarding. It was probably a while ago. Any regrets so far? Answers 1 through 5. All right, that's almost all of you. One more? All right, it's the most... All right, now you're just messing with me. Project 1, though, seems to be the biggest regret. We're nearing the end for $500,000. Uh-oh, I'm not serious again. What do I get if I win this game? Ooh, maybe he's being surprisingly generous. No, you can win a nano from either of the 2 surveys from this semester. But what do you get if you win this game for $500,000? You better get the answer right. So you didn't see me walk in with an iPod, let me tell you. All right. Not sure what's going on there. Finally, our final question and the last thing you will learn in computer science E259 is the following. If you were an XML-related technology, which would you be? An existential question with which to end the course. Again, please cut me some slack. These were funny when I wrote them. I need a laugh track for next year's distance course. Oh, what happened to three? What happened to three? Well, XSLT, I'm not too quick. I don't know why it's not showing up. Oh, that's weird. PowerPoint bug. Four. Five. Six. I'm glad that one went over well. Seven. I thought these are quite clever, frankly. Eight. One through eight. So go ahead and let's get this clock started. Go ahead. Your favorite answer. If you were an XML-related technology, which would you be? One through eight. Almost all of you. Four or five to go. Almost all of you. Four to go. Two to go. 22 seconds to make your decision. Which would you be? One more. Who's not on the board? Who's not on the board? All right. The most popular choice of technologies was four, which was SVG. What a humble class. SVG, I'm pretty to look at, followed by three and five, which were XSLT, I'm not too quick, SGML, I'm old and deprecated, finally eight, which was XML, why be one language when I can be them all. So, congratulations on completing Computer Science E259. I look forward to seeing your final projects in a couple of weeks' time. In the meantime, if you have any questions, feel free to email, call me, or meet in person. Otherwise, I look forward to seeing them. So thank you very much.